Are you ready? It's time for On the Double with the Double S Express. Great sports talk and big time guests with Sean Wally and Sean Boyd. On the Double with the Double S Express.
Hey everybody, what's going on? Sean Wally alongside Sean Boyd, and yes, we are live for On the Double here on this National Championship Monday night.
Man, Sean, it has been such a while. We have to address this because, you know, for our listeners and our fans that, you know, that text us and call us and say, hey, what's going on? We've been getting these, you know, recorded shows. Man, it has been a while, Sean Wally, and we cannot go on with this show without recognizing that, but it's with just reason.
That is for sure. You know, it used to be just one of us was globetrotting, and now it is two.
Man, it's been such a fantastic journey going around and being on tour with the Harlem Globetrotters, man. And I can't begin to tell you the excitement and the fervor that I have gained from this experience, Sean. And you know, moving forward, there are some great things that are definitely going to come out of this, no doubt.
Well, yeah, there are definitely some things in the pipeline for one, if not both of us. And, you know, good things can come from any situation. And heck, you know, you're hours away from heading to Mexico.
Yeah, so, you know, took a quick break from, you know, wow, the journey started in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and then we globetrotted our way to the East Coast and to the Midwest, and now I got a quick break, but yeah, just like you said, heading to Mexico in a couple of days, so I'm looking forward to that.
So, Sean, what was your biggest takeaway? You had about a month on tour with the Globetrotters as public address announcer. What was your biggest takeaway from that experience?
Man, that it's a tough grind. You know, a lot of the times, you know, on the outside looking in, I know a lot of our listeners are like, oh man, it's the greatest thing in the world, which it is. The experience is something that I will continue to take and move forward within the organization. But it's hard, man. It's hard work. You know, one of the things that, you know, I always wondered with you is, you know, as far as doing the show was, how were you able to do it? And I'm still trying to figure that out because, you know, we're in different cities. We wake up and, you know, we do a show in one city and then at the end of the night, we're in another city. And, you know, it's kind of tough to keep things, you know, on the straight because you don't know where you are half the time. You know, it's, you know, yeah. I could be introducing and saying hello to one city and we would be in another, but you know, man, it's a tough grind, but it's so rewarding. And the reason why I say it's rewarding, Sean, is because of the smiles and the laughter and the cheer that we put into people's lives and on their faces. And you know, they come up to us and they just thank us for a great time. And I didn't expect that. I knew that it was a fun, exciting family atmosphere, but I didn't expect the heart tugging that I got from, you know, the people that, you know, Sean, people have tough days, man. They have tough lives. It's rough. And, you know, then when they come to you and say, hey, man, thank you for this great show because, you know, life isn't that great for us on the outside. And you gave us hope. You gave us a glimmer. You know, that's what it's all about, Sean, and that's what I took away.
So your first stop is probably one you'll never forget, going to Puerto Rico.
Yeah, so, you know, we head to Puerto Rico, nice, warm atmosphere there. The weather was awesome, beautiful, beautiful country. And, you know, if there's any way that you want to kick off your tour, kick it off in Puerto Rico, man. And that was a lot of fun for a lot of reasons, Sean, because for one, we're in Puerto Rico. The other is that it was a brand new tour. So we were, you know, all of us were learning each other. And you know, just like anything, like the first day of school, a brand new job, you name it, it's tough. And when you have the added pressure on perfection, it seems like you're in a vacuum and you're pressing and you're trying to make things work and you want it to happen like yesterday. But then you also understand that there's a progression, and the quicker that you can come together as a group, you know, the better you're going to become. And I think that, you know, Puerto Rico was the best place to get that started.
Yeah, Sean, it's definitely a great thing to have people come together from all walks of life, all parts of the country, if not the globe in some cases, and form a team and create that bond and get to know people and come together as a group and be one cohesive unit.
Yeah, and speaking of, because, you know, you've asked where I started, and of course in Puerto Rico, and now going to end it in Mexico. Where are you right now?
Well, Sean, I know you're basking in the 80, 85 degrees in the Sacramento, California area. I am on the other end of the spectrum, in and around Toronto, Canada, 25 degrees, had about 3 to 4 inches of snow yesterday, so it is bitter cold outside. But hey, getting to see parts of the world I've never been to, so it's definitely a fun time.
Yeah, you know, I was just where you were a couple of weeks ago, actually a week and a half ago, on that East Coast swing. And, you know, of course, in Providence and Connecticut, and up there in Maine, you know, as you're saying, you know, visiting and going to places where I never would have expected or thought to go. And yeah, man, it's cold there this time of the year.
You know, you got to go to Maine. We end our tour April 24th, north of Maine, far northeast Canada, in a town called Moncton, M-O-N-C-T-O-N. So that should be interesting. I'm not sure if I'm going to see icebergs, igloos, or what's going on up there.
Well, if anything, man, make sure that you frequent a, you know, any of the local restaurants and, you know, get one of those, what are they, lobster, anything that has to do with lobster, man, because I hear that it's to die for up there. I didn't get a chance to when I was in Maine. And I'm kicking myself. I got a lot of friends and family are like, oh, man, you got to get the lobster bisque, or you got to get the lobster. And I didn't get a chance to. So, Sean, please make sure that when you're up there, you get some of the favorites, famous seafood up there in the northeast part of the country.
Well, that's part of the fun of traveling to places you've never been, is trying the local fare, the local food, the culinary arts from that region. And so it'll definitely be interesting to see what we find in further northeast Canada in a couple weeks.
Yeah, you know, and then that would give you the chance to actually see who has the better crab, if the Pacific Northwest has it or the Northeast has it. You know, you got to make sure that you get some of that awesome seafood.
Man, you're forgetting I'm not the biggest seafood fan, unless it's fish. It comes in the shell. But, you know, I have expanded my horizons, as you know, last August, trying oysters and things like that. So, you know, maybe, just maybe, I'll try something new here in the coming weeks as we go further north and further east.
Yeah, you got to, man. You got to. That's all a part of the traveling. You know, it's a part of the perks. You got to step out and try something new.
Well, Sean, we haven't been live in a while, and we have a big-time guest scheduled for tonight, and that is Jeff Baker, the sports enterprise and investigative reporter for the Seattle Times. So it'll be great to have Jeff on and get his insight on what's going on with the Seattle Arena, and also talk about his illustrious career in the world of sports writing. He's covered teams in Montreal and Toronto and been in Seattle for a long time. And let's go out to the holysmokenuts.com phone lines and welcome Jeff in now. Jeff, thanks for your time tonight.
Hey, glad to be on.
Hey, Jeff, thanks for being on, man. And what Sean and I were just talking about is, we were talking about the goings on, or maybe not goings on, with the stadium for the, or the arena for the Seattle, man, whether it's an NHL or, man, the future Sonics, what's going on with that?
Well, there's been a lot of politics holding the whole thing up, and you know, and it's getting really intense as we get closer and closer to crunch time on a decision about this arena. I mean, One of the issues is that Chris Hansen, the gentleman who's building the arena in the Soto area of Seattle, that's going to be right next to the baseball and football stadiums, he wants to get up to $200 million in city bond funding and county bond funding in order to build this arena. And in order to do that, he's got to get an NBA team. And the problem is the NBA has said that it's not expanding anytime soon. There's no team slated for relocation to Seattle anytime soon. And this deal that Hansen has for the bond money, it's going to run out in November of 2017. So he's running out of time to get all this done. There's still some hurdles that have to be overcome locally here in order to get his arena even shovel-ready and permitted, in order to build something. And until he really gets that in place, he can't go to the NBA and say, hey, could you speed up your expansion time frame a little bit for me here? And so that's where we're at right now. Right now, Hansen needs the city to give him part of a street so that he can actually build the arena, because the arena plans run right through a street that exists here in downtown Seattle. And all these opponents are lining up now, from the Port of Seattle, from Maritime Unions, the Seattle Mariners. There's all these groups that are opposed to putting an arena there in the first place because they say it's going to muck up their business. And so they're fighting the street decision. And if Hansen can't get that street pretty soon, he's not going to be able to have a shovel-ready plan that he can go to the NBA with and say, hey, I need to get this team, like, lickety-split so I can get the bond funded. And so that's where we're at. There's a whole bunch of catch-22s here. And so we've kind of been in this arena limbo going on about 2 years now, and things are starting to come to a head because the city's going to vote on whether to give him the street in about another month or so, and things are getting really heated now as all the pro forces and the con forces line up for and against it.
Now, Jeff, one of the things that you put in the Seattle Times on, March 30th, was the officials are asking for event scheduling deals. So what's that all about? So you're saying that Chris Hansen has to come up with a proposal, but there's no way that he can come up with event scheduling if he doesn't have an NBA franchise.
Well, there are ways you can model it with computers using examples in other cities. I mean, they've already looked at cities like Los Angeles and how they manage multiple teams. They've looked at cities like Philadelphia and how they manage multiple teams in various sites. What you can do is make up a mock schedule pretending that you have a team and see how these dates would conflict back and forth. I mean, the whole object is to make sure you don't have too many days where the Mariners are playing, let's say, baseball at around the same time as a hockey game or a basketball game is scheduled, or you don't want them scheduled back-to-back on the same days. You try to avoid that stuff as much as possible, and what you try to avoid as well is the triple threat. What you really don't want is to have a Mariners game going on, a Seattle Sounders soccer game going on, because those fill the stadium pretty well, or a Seattle Seahawks football game going on at the same time as a baseball game and a basketball game and a hockey game, because that's really going to mess things up, and you're going to get a lot of people in the streets, and it's a really crowded corridor to begin with. And so that's why you would have the event scheduling, to try to, hammer out a series of rules ahead of time to say, no, under no circumstances can we have these scheduled at such and such a time. You have to abide by this framework, and we have to make sure we don't have these events on conflicting dates.
Jeff Baker of the Seattle Times joining us. Jeff, what is the biggest issue with Chris Hansen just going ahead and building the arena, getting the shovels in the ground? Is it just because he wants to be assured of that team first? Does he not think that he should move forward and then the teams will come?
No, that's a good question. I mean, the biggest issue really is the money. He says he needs the money. He needs the $200 million in bond funding. And the city and county won't give him that bond funding until he actually gets the team. As far as, let's say, he was to take his own money and go all private to start with, I mean, there's been a lot of questions about whether they would let him do that, especially for hockey, because there's no provision here to give him any money just for hockey. It only involves NBA or NBA plus NHL. There's no NHL team coming here alone. In no way will he get money if he asks for that, because the city and county think it's too big a risk just to have hockey here. So, I mean, there's been a question of that, but, I mean, Chris Hansen's been pretty adamant that he needs that government funding to go forward, that the deal doesn't pencil out without it. He's had talks with a would-be NHL owner, a guy named Victor Coleman down in Los Angeles, who wants to bring an NHL team here. They've had discussions about trying to make the finances work to go all private, potentially, to bring a hockey team here, but they've yet to come to any kind of an agreement. And there's a question of whether the city would even let him do that because of all the opposition that's been raised But you know, you've got beyond just the money part, you've got those other groups. Like I said, the Port of Seattle, the maritime workers. There's a lot of jobs that in and around that port area where the stadiums are located, and there's a real culture clash going on. You know, between people who feel that that should remain an industrial zone versus those who want to see it become a sports and entertainment district, kind of like what LA Live has, you know, with the Staples Center and all the events going on around it. That's kind of what Chris Hansen's vision is for that area, and there's a lot of opposition there by the industrial people who work there.
Jeff, on your point to that culture clash, why do you think the Mariners seem to be so opposed to this, and do you think they really have a gripe?
Well, you know, it's a little hypocritical of the Mariners to have this kind of gripe because, after all, they went and got a taxpayer-subsidized stadium built smack dab in the middle of that neighborhood. Now they're complaining how this other sports stadium's going to mess up traffic in the area. It's a little too late because the Mariners have already done that on their own. I mean, that's part of the issue. The Mariners feel there's already traffic chaos down there, you know, when they have games featuring them at the same time as the Seattle Sounders are playing soccer. You know, it turns into a quagmire in the streets there at times, and so they don't want to see that added to. They feel that there's mitigation measures that were already supposed to be taken in the area to help traffic, and they haven't been taken, so this will only make things worse. You know, part of me also feels it's competition. I mean, there's only so many dollars in Seattle. As much as we like to talk about how much money we have in the city compared to other cities, I mean, we're not a megalopolis like Toronto or like New York or something like that. You know, we're still a fairly small-sized city, and there's only going to be so many dollars that go around to support major sports teams. And, you know, if you count the football Huskies in college football, they get $70,000 a game. I mean, you know, there's a question of how many dollars one city like this could actually support. And you know, you start talking about luxury suites in an arena and who's going to buy them and stuff. You know, maybe some of the Mariners, you know, luxury suite customers start going across the street to the hockey and basketball games. And all of a sudden it hurts the Mariners' bottom line. You know, that could be a very big reason why they would oppose a plan like this. And I think that has something to do with it.
Jeff Baker, Enterprise and investigative reporter for the Seattle Times, joining us here on The Double. Now, in a nutshell, Jeff, do you see this deal actually falling into place or this deal happening?
Wow, that's a good question. I think, you know what, you talk to people behind the scenes, and a lot of them think that all this political jockeying we see going on in public is all a moot point anyway, because unless the NBA is going to give Chris Hansen a team, you know, very soon, within the next year and a half, this whole deal might not happen anyway. And that's going to be a big question, is will the NBA suddenly speed up its expansion plans? You know, if Chris Hansen can say, look, I've got all my permitting done, I've got a shovel-ready plan to show you, can you please just give me a team right now? Will the NBA listen? I mean, I've asked Adam Silver the question a couple of times directly, and he's told me that they're in no hurry to expand. They're not even going to start talking expansion for about another 2 years, and they've got their collective bargaining agreement coming up early next year. There's going to be a window to opt out, and you know, there could be a labor stoppage. They're working towards not having a labor stoppage in the NBA, but you'd have to imagine they're not going to expand anywhere before that is all hammered out and worked out. And if that takes until, you know, mid to late summer of next year, that there's really no way that they're going to award an expansion team to Seattle before November of 2017, and that's when Hansen's deal for the bond money runs out. Now, you ask, could they expand that deal? They could probably extend it a little bit, but this is such a political hot potato right now, I wouldn't bank on city council actually voting to approve an extension of that. So there's really a time crunch here to get an expansion team from the NBA before November of 2017, before the deal runs out, because no deal, no bond money, no arena. And, you know, a lot of it's in the NBA's court. If they keep saying no, if they keep saying we're going to wait on expansion, this deal probably won't happen.
Now, of course, with Adam Silver coming out and saying that he's not looking for a franchise anytime soon, is the NBA in trouble as far as revenue is concerned?
Well, I don't think they're in trouble because of revenue. They just signed a $24 billion television deal. So, and that's part of the issue with the whole CBA is, you know, how are they going to split that deal up? They're worried about carving it up with their existing teams and how much money everybody's going to keep. You know, until they figure that out, they're not really ready to bring more partners into the equation to split the pie up even more ways. But no, I don't think they're in trouble revenue-wise. I think there are some markets in the NBA that are in financial trouble. And Silver's alluded to that a couple of times when I've asked him the question directly. You know, he says that he's told me that they had about, this was about a year ago, he told me they had about 8 teams that you know, they were really keeping an eye on financially, and they wanted to shore those teams up before they even think about expanding. And you're not going to shore them up in a year or two. I mean, it's going to take a little bit of time. So, you know, he says that their biggest goal near term is to firm up all of their existing teams. And then after that, and once you get the CBA done, and once you figure out how you're going to split TV revenue, after that, then you look to expand. And it makes sense from a time frame, a timeline perspective. And, you know, that's why there's quite a few people in this city that don't think Chris Hansen's going to be able to get the NBA team, even if he was to get all his arena stuff lined up. And that's a big question. So we'll have to figure that out in the next few months.
Jeff Baker of the Seattle Times with us. Jeff, as you well know and have written about, there is a proposal on the table to the city of Seattle to refurbish and renovate Key Arena for cheaper than a brand new arena. Why is that not getting serious look?
Yeah, well, that's another big question. And you know, the city kept very quiet about that study. They didn't put it out in public for quite a long time. And it was initially supposed to come out in May of last year, and it didn't even get mentioned to the media until late September after a bunch of public records requests. Now, that's a very good question, because there's been interest expressed by at least one guy, the hockey guy I told you about, Victor Coleman in Los Angeles, was shown the report last August, and he told the city he was interested in pursuing that renovation option. And what happened after that was the city went and consulted with its lawyers, and what the lawyers told the city was that you'd be breaking your contractual obligations with Chris Hansen and his project in the Soto District if you were to entertain offers to renovate Key Arena. They're saying that the city is contractually bound to Hansen through the end of that deal that I was just talking about, through November of 2017, and if they start helping other people at a rival site try to develop that, then they would be violating the spirit of their agreement, and they could get sued by Chris Hansen. That's what they claim their biggest fear is. I mean, there's been a lot of debate about whether that's actually accurate, but you know, that's going to be up for judges and courts to figure out if it ever came to that. But I think the city right now is trying to avoid a lawsuit that way. And, you know, I've heard a lot of comments behind the scenes from people who say that the city feels like its hands are tied to Chris Hansen right now, that it's handcuffed. It's prevented from doing anything with Key Arena. And there are a lot of city council members who would actually like to explore that option, but they're not doing it. Another reason also, that I should be fair, I mean, another reason is there are people that worry that even if you spend $285 million, and fix Key Arena, it's going to be too small. It'll be one of the smallest arenas in the NBA. The report that looked at the renovation actually addressed that, and it said that because the new arena that's being built in Sacramento is actually smaller than the normal NBA arenas of the past, it's kind of a new arena design, a new standard, let's say, that the league is now allowing, where you can build smaller arenas as long as they're higher end and upscale and can cater to the fans in a specific way. And that's, you know, that would be the model that they would adapt here in Seattle. So a lot of people are afraid of building it. They think it'll be too small. But the people who are pushing the renovation say that, no, it would be acceptable to the NBA because there is a new standard now based on Sacramento as to what they would allow as far as arenas go.
Jeff, the Seattle City Council held meetings last month about vacating that portion of Occidental that this arena in Seattle would need. I believe the vote is within the next month. Where do you see that going when push comes to shove?
Well, that's going to be a close vote. You know, and there's a lot of jockeying going on behind the scenes. Again, there's some council members who feel this is all a moot point, that they shouldn't even be voting on it in the first place because the NBA might not give Chris Hansen a team, and then they'll have done this whole exercise for nothing. There's people who feel that it's wasting valuable city time, that until he has a team, Chris Hansen has a team, they shouldn't be deciding on something. There's people that say it's illegal for the city to vote to give Hansen the street, because if they give him the street, they're effectively giving him the arena permission. And they say they can't do that because the city hasn't even officially decided that the arena is in the right location to begin with, and that they're supposed to negotiate terms with him and then sign off on it in a future vote. And they haven't done that yet, so they're saying, how can you give him a street and basically give him the arena when you haven't even decided whether that's the best site of all the sites you're supposed to be studying. So there's going to be lawsuits. There's going to be, you know, all kinds of things that come down if they actually do vote to give him the street. And so that's going to be an interesting question. I've heard that they're going to attach a whole list of conditions to it. Even if they do give him the street, they're going to say one of the conditions is you have to get an NBA team if you're going to, if we're going to give you a street. We're not going to give you the street, and you can't start hammering and digging stuff up tomorrow. You're going to have to go get the team. You're going to have to do all these other things. And if you do all of those, then we'll give you the street. And even that's not going to be enough for some opponents. They'll say that's too much because you're basically giving them the street on a list of conditions, and you can't legally do that. And so there's going to be, you know, there's been all kinds of lawsuits threatened, and I'm sure some stuff's going to hit the fan if that actually gets done.
Jeff Baker of the Seattle Times joining us here on The Double. And Jeff, we have been hammering away on trying to figure out ways and getting this arena here to Seattle. I do want to touch on something a little different you wrote on just yesterday, I believe, and that was former Seahawks Patrick Kearney and the feel-good story that's going on with Patrick as far as him getting his degree at Columbia. And, you know, because the reason being, the reason why I ask this is because, you know, we don't know what happens to players after they're done playing in the NFL or the NBA or whatever. And this is a story here with Patrick Kearney to where he's doing some positive things, and it sounds like he's going to be helping a lot of people moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of his goals when he retired. I mean, he retired a little early. He had 3 years to go on his contract, but his body was all smashed up, and, you know, he just couldn't play anymore. He had shoulder injuries, hip injuries. I believe he had a concussion or two. And, you know, but he was a smart guy financially. And, you know, he was always business inclined, numbers inclined, finance inclined. And then he went and got his degree, like I said, at Columbia's business school. And, you know, right after that, he became an NFL vice president of benefits. And his goal, his main goal, was to establish this camp that the NFL now runs every year. This is the second year it's running it. They're running it down in Fort Lauderdale where they call it a financial boot camp. And so players get to go down there and take these intensive courses over 4 days of learning about personal finance, learning about, you know, tax incentives, learning basically how to manage their money so that they don't run out of it in a few years. And so that was his big goal, his big baby when he took over that NFL job. He had the job for 18 months, and then he told me, like, once that was done, that was it. Like, that was the real thing he wanted to establish. And then he's since moved on into the more private financial sector. But he's actually going back to give a couple of sessions a day at this financial boot camp that they're running in Fort Lauderdale. And I believe they have 43 players and spouses that are going to be attending total. Former players and current players, and about 15 wives are coming along too, because, you know, as we all know, sometimes it's the wives that run the household finances, and so they might as well get a gander at it. And so, yeah, he was very excited about getting to do that. And especially nowadays, with all the talk we have about concussions, every day you're hearing something new about CTE and the impact of concussions. You see more and more players retiring young so that they can actually live out their later years. You know, this stuff's going to become important. I think that's one of the reasons Marshawn Lynch retired like he did so quickly here in Seattle. He's only 29, and a lot of people saw him at the peak of his career, but, I mean, he took a pounding physically over the years here. And, you know, he's privately said to teammates that he's a little concerned at times about what his future health is going to look like down the road. I mean, you can't get smashed up like that and not feel it later on. And you know, I fully believe that's one of the reasons he left the game as early as he did. And he managed his money extremely well, according to anybody you talk to. And, you know, hopefully he'll be able to live out into his 50s and 60s and 70s, you know, in relatively decent shape and in good financial shape. But a lot of players can't do that, and that's one of the reasons Kearney wanted to set this program up.
Now, Jeff, of course, you had mentioned, you know, some of the injuries with especially NFL players because of the beating and the, you know, the pounding that they take. Did you get a chance to watch the movie Concussion?
Oh, yeah. I saw the movie Concussion, yeah.
It's
frightening when you think about it, when you think about how much was going on and how much people knew about. And, you know, stuff's coming out now every day about what was known and what wasn't known. And you know that the players weren't given the full picture of what they were putting their bodies through.
And so, you know, so now we have the Patrick Kearneys, the Marshawn Lynches that are standing in the gap and doing some great things and helping these players out. And, of course, you know, they need it, because I had no clue that this type of thing was going on. I mean, you know, CTE is something that is, oh, my goodness. I mean, after watching the movie, I scratched my head and I'm like, what in the world is going on?
Well, I mean, you remember what happened. Even like, it was starting to seem odd. I mean, I'm a big Pittsburgh Steelers fan, and I have been my whole life. And then, you know, you see Mike Webster dying as young as he did, and then you see, Justin Strelzik dying in that fiery crash, on the highway. And then you had the Javon Belcher incident in Kansas City a couple of years ago, where he shoots his girlfriend and goes and kills himself, commits suicide at the team's training facility, and you're wondering, like, what's going on? Are these, are the players just all born crazy? And no, they're not. There was actually something causing a lot of this, and Belcher has since been found to have CTE as well. It explains a lot of what we've seen going on with some football players off the field, and a lot of stuff that's really coming to light recently. Let's face it, players are a lot bigger today. They're a lot faster. I grew up in Canada, where they play football on a much bigger field than they do here in the U.S., and I think that might be something that they might have to look at here in the United States, because the field here is almost getting too small for the players that you see nowadays. When you got linemen that can run a sub 5:40 and they weigh 330, 340 pounds, I mean, there's no room to get out of the way. Watch football. Go back and watch football tapes from when, like, Frank Gifford played halfback for the New York Giants in the late 50s. And you watch how they do these little toss sweeps around the corner. You can't do that anymore. The game's changed. You can't run side to side like that. You'll run out of room in 2 seconds because the linebackers are too fast. They'll chase you down and they'll cut you off before you even start to turn the corner. There's just no room. Guys are getting slammed in to one another at full speed, and they use their head a lot more than they used to. They're trying to make those big hits to get on ESPN every night. You know, whereas 20, 30 years ago, they made proper shoulder tackles. They wrapped. They did all this stuff. Now everybody's flying at each other like missiles, head first, trying to take guys out. And I have no doubt that that's contributing to a lot more of these stories that we're hearing about, as opposed to in the old days when they wore just simple padded helmets and, didn't have as much protection. But I think they were probably a little more careful with how they played the game back then.
Jeff, I know we've got to let you run, get to your evening, but we could talk to you for hours with what you've covered and written about in your illustrious...
Yeah, I talk a lot. I'm told I talk a lot, and I can keep radio.
No way. For hours. No,
we
love it.
It's amazing. We could have you on for hours, Jeff, but I got two quick ones for you. We'll let you run.
Sure.
In your illustrious sports writing career, what are you most proud of? You've won an immense number of awards, both in Canada and the U.S. What are your fondest memories, and what are you most proud of?
Oh, man, it's hard to say. I'll tell you what, in 2005, when I was with the Toronto Star, I went down to the Dominican Republic for a week, and I hooked up with the right people, and we went and we did a bunch of stories on the steroid use down there by teenage baseball prospects, and that got a lot of recognition at the time, and ended up winning a national award in Canada and here in the United States as well, and that's one of the things that got me into this country to work, because I'm a Canadian-born citizen, and so that got me the visas and then the green card to come and work down here based on that. And I enjoyed that because it involved going to a foreign country. It involved going to places where, most people couldn't go on their own. I had to arrange it with locals to take me certain places and meet certain people. And we did a lot of stuff. And it was, that kind of thing that takes place away from the playing field. As I get older in my life, I tend to enjoy the stories that go on off the field a lot more than what actually takes place on the field. I've covered hundreds of baseball games, probably thousands of baseball games professionally and other sports professionally. But the games themselves don't really mean as much. I mean, you and I just sat here talking about an arena and what's going on away from the field. We've talked about, what's really happening, the serious problems that are happening now injury-wise and health-wise in football. I mean, that takes way higher precedence than anything that's going on the field with who's scoring touchdowns and who's making tackles. I mean, that stuff's almost inconsequential to a certain degree. And I'm finding that a lot more of my stuff gears towards that. So the series of stories I did from there, I was pretty proud of. And my photographer, Peter Power, who was working there with me from the Toronto Star, he shot some really, really good photographs down there. Actually, one of them got used in the Ken Burns documentary on baseball, not the original one, but the follow-up one he had about 5 years ago. They used one of Peter's photos to illustrate the Dominican baseball chapter. So that was fun because I remember Peter stepping out of the cab to shoot the picture of a kid who was throwing pitches in a farmer's field with some cows as a backdrop. And, to see it on TV on the big screen, that was pretty special.
And, Jeff, as we discussed yesterday, I am in the Toronto area, and then I'll be in Montreal on Friday, two places you know well. anything I need to do while I'm in your old stomping grounds?
Oh, yeah. Well, if you're in Montreal, you got to go have smoked meat. And, you know, most people go to Schwartz's. That's on St. Lawrence Boulevard, Rue St. Laurent, they call it, Boulevard St. Laurent in French. But Schwartz's now, unfortunately, usually has a lineup going around the corner. But, you know, there's other places you can go. There's places like Dunn's. I think Ben's is still around. I mean, just ask your hotel concierge. They'll tell you where the best smoked meat place is other than Schwartz's, if you ask them. But that's one place to go. You got to have poutine, which is French fries, gravy, and cheese curds. And you can get that just about any restaurant around.
Wow.
You should try to have crepes, too. Try to have French crepes for breakfast. There's some good places around downtown and old Montreal where you can go and get those, and they make them authentic. That's always a good bet. But the poutine is easy. If you go to La Belle Provence, which is a fast food joint, you can get it for like $2, or you can go get it at a high-end restaurant for $15 somewhere. But most places will have poutine.
Jeff Faker, thank you so much for your time, your insight, and man, we got so much more we could get into. Love to have you back on the show at a later date. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeff.
No problem. Good talking to you guys.
There goes Jeff Baker. You can follow him on Twitter at Jeff with a G, G-E-O-F-F, Baker Times on Twitter.
Man, you know, we talked about a lot of stuff. You know, Jeff mentioned, you know, we're talking about the arena. We talked about the health of players in the NFL. And man, what intrigued me the most was the poutine, Sean Wally. Man, you got to get some of that.
Hey, I can tell you it's Jared Lewis's, one of his favorites when we come up into Canada, for sure.
Well, we're going to take a quick break.
I'm Chris Walls, and I'm a truck driver from Missouri. For 13 hours a night, I sit in my truck and I drive. Out of boredom, I'll stop and eat. If I'm not doing fast food, I guarantee there's a bag of chips open on my dashboard. Along with that, I'm good for about 4 liters of soda a night. That was all until Andro 400. I started out 4 months ago weighing 341 pounds, and since taking Andro 400, I have dropped 45 pounds. I'm sleeping better. There's no cravings. There's no excessive thirst. My knee pain went away. I've had some lower back issues, and I've noticed that that went away, and I can only contribute that to Andro 400. One thing that Andro 400 said on the radio ad says it attacks belly fat. Well, let me tell you, it did. I've lost 6 inches. This product really does work.
So guys, if you'd like to experience similar results, then get Andro 400. The safe, natural, and inexpensive way to boost your testosterone. Go to andro400.com. andro400.com. Guys, are you tired of being tired? Frustrated because it seems impossible to lose belly fat? If you're looking for a solution, then listen to Mark.
I had fantastic results with the Andro 400 Max. Probably lost 35 pounds, and more impressive than that was the inches I lost off of my belly and my waist. And the increased energy is fantastic. I'll be totally honest, I tried a different product, and I wasn't happy with the different product. You guys are considerably cheaper than the other brand, and I can really feel the difference.
Andro 400 Max, the extra strength, all natural testosterone booster. The safe, easy, and affordable way to gain energy and lose stubborn belly fat. Satisfaction guaranteed or your money back. Feel and look like a new man. Go to andro400.com or call 888-400-0435. 888-400-0435.
Are you tired of the gym scene in Tri-Cities, Washington? Tired of seeing all those ridiculous gym selfies? If you are ready to work on a better you, Power Alley Performance is the place you can reach your goals. From one-on-one personal training to group fitness sessions, the trainers at Power Alley Performance will help motivate you every step of the way. Trainers DJ and Lamont have a wealth of knowledge and experience that they are ready to share with you. Call Power Alley today at 509-554-4785 and tell them the Double S Express sent you for a complimentary half-hour session. Visit PowerAlleyPerformance.com.
What's my image?
What's my image?
What's my image?
At Images Barbershop and Styles, you get the best cut, the best design, and the best styles in the Sacramento area. Plus the affordable price, along with the fun, family-friendly atmosphere, you'll walk away with a look of satisfaction and the feeling of a new you. Do you have your image?
We have ours!
Images Barbershop and Styles, located at 10040 Bruceville Road, Elk Grove, California, Suite 140. For appointments, call 916-271-0218. That's Images Barbershop and Styles.
Who likes the inconvenience of car repairs? Not only do car repairs take time and money from you, but can you even trust your repair shop? Nate, Dave, and the team at Platinum Automotive Services in Tri-Cities, Washington are honest and trustworthy, and they take great care of your vehicle. From the basic oil change to full engine rebuilds, they do it all. Like the Platinum Automotive Services Facebook page for a shot at a free oil change. Platinum Automotive Services, platinum service without the platinum price.
Welcome back to On the Double with the Double S Express, Sean Wally and Sean Boyd.
Some legends are told, some turn to dust or to gold, but you will remember me.
Welcome back to On the Double with the Double S Express. Believe it or not, Sean Wally and Sean Boyd are live for this show, and we had big-time guest Jeff Baker of the Seattle Times on a fabulous interview, talking all kinds of stuff, and we've got a lot more to get to, Sean, from the NCAA championship basketball game going on as we speak, opening day in Major League Baseball, so much, so little time.
Well, yeah, man, you know, when you listen to On the Double, you are a diehard fan of On the Double, because we go up against a lot of things, Sean. We go up against the NCAA basketball tournament right now. We've gone up against the national championship in the winter, and here we are, you know, still plugging away and giving great sports insight, man. And as you're mentioning, Jeff Baker on, man, that was a great guest to have.
And Sean, it is, as we said, opening day for Major League Baseball. Certain teams think they're going to win all 162 games after a victory today or yesterday for those three or four teams that played on Sunday, but things did not go Seattle's way in Texas this afternoon.
Man, Sean, you know, I believe that we talk about this year in and year out, and as much as I'm excited about opening day, it's just opening day. There's 161 more games after opening day, and if your team wins, of course it'd be great to ride that bandwagon and say, oh, man, we are on our way to an AL championship, ALCS championships, the whole nine. But it's just one game. And, you know, things are going to get better. You're talking about your beloved Seattle Mariners, of course, with King Felix on the mound. It just seems like it's a done deal because we're so used to seeing King Felix dominating. He did okay. He had six strikeouts. It wasn't bad. I believe he pitched five innings. It's just that there's not enough run support, and this, again, is just game one. But Texas had just enough to win 3-2. I'm expecting the Seattle Mariners to actually play a little better than they did last year. Let's face it. The Mariners came out preseason-wise. Man, we had them all the way into the World Series. There are some reporters and analysts that said that Seattle was the team to beat, and then things didn't wind up materializing. Of course, there's been a lot of changes with the Seattle Mariners. They've beefed up their batting a little bit, which I like. And then we're still going to expect Robbie Cano and we're expecting Robbie Cano to do some great things. And so, you know, I believe Seattle will be a better team than they were last year.
Well, Sean, you mentioned Robinson Cano, and all the talk in spring training was how healthy he is, and you'll see a different Robbie Cano in 2016 than you did in 2015 when he was battling a few injuries. And heck, it showed out. First inning, a solo line drive blast over the wall off of Texas ace Cole Hamels. And you're thinking, okay, here we go. Mariners might do something. Second inning, Kyle Seager, same thing. A booming home run to right center field. Like, okay, 2-0, two home runs in two innings, and then no support after that. Cole Hamels found his curveball. And what was very interesting with King Felix, I don't know if you were aware or noticed or got to see any of it. It was on ESPN, Sean. But King Felix had a no-hitter into that fifth inning. It surprised me when they threw the stats up, and I was like, whoa, we got a no-no into the fifth. And then all of a sudden, the wheels fell off, and that's when the Rangers scored their three runs, was in that fifth inning. There were walks, there were errors in the field, and Felix was mad at himself because he walked in the first run with the bases loaded. So things went right in some areas, but obviously not right in others, and really that's how a game goes. You have highs and lows, and you figure it out after nine innings. And unfortunately for the Mariners and fortunately for the Rangers were on top.
Yeah, you know, those things happen in game one. You know, you expect, you know, funfair and excitement in opening day, and it was just that. I mean, we saw former President George Bush at the game. The home run that you were talking about, the mammoth shot that Kyle Seager hit in right center, that was in the deepest part of Arlington Stadium. You know, but then you got a chance to see some of the mistakes that were going on, not just with the players, but with the umpiring. What in the world was going on when Prince Fielder got to the plate and he dodges a curveball that was going to his feet? He lunges over home plate and they call interference? I mean, you know, thank goodness that didn't come back to haunt the Rangers even more. But, you know, it's those little nuances that you just say, hey, it's the beginning of the season. You know, things will get better. And I believe for the Mariners, you know, pitching is one of the things that they were looking to accomplish and become stronger with in the offseason. I believe they've accomplished that along with the bats. And so, you know, again, it's just game number one.
Yeah, that play with Prince Fielder being called out as the hitter, not even swinging at the pitch, crossing over home plate, losing his balance, getting out of the way of a curveball. It's one of those weird, nuanced plays that you don't see very often. And as the broadcast crew on ESPN was saying, they believe there's a rule that says you cannot cross over home plate when a catcher is having to throw. So there wasn't that big of an argument by the Rangers. I mean, the manager did go out there and get the explanation. He wasn't happy, of course, because his player was out, one of his best hitters. But, yeah, it's one of those weird ones. You just kind of scratch your head.
Yeah, you know, when I first saw it, I was like, what in the world? What kind of rule is this that we're talking about? But, yeah, you know, the Rangers didn't make too big of a deal out of it. It was a casual conversation between, you know, the manager and the umpire, and, you know, just kind of stalled the game a little bit. But, yeah, man, outside of that, I thought it was a great game. I thought ESPN picked, you know, an awesome one to televise. And, you know, we'll see what the Texas Rangers do moving forward. It's great to get that win. And then, of course, Seattle has their home openers coming up. When is that? Is that next week?
Well, I can tell you after the three-game series in Arlington, the Mariners head to your neck of the woods to take on the A's before, yes, coming up the Pacific Coast to Seattle and hosting the Angels next week.
Well, you know, I'm so excited about the Oakland A's, you know, and for just reason. Year in and year out, you just don't know what you're going to get. You know how Billy Beane is and how he doesn't keep players, you know, marquee players. It seems like every year we're trading all-stars. And so you don't know what you're going to get as far as the lineup is concerned. But this year I'm a little intrigued. And so, you know, I thought that Sonny Gray was supposed to to pitch tonight, opening night, but he got a bout of food poisoning. So go figure that. So, you know, it sounds like he's going to pitch tomorrow, so it doesn't really mess up their rotation too much. Rich Hill, somebody who they required, who they acquired in the offseason, left-hand pitcher is on the mound. So you're exchanging one lefty for another. This one, right now is going, the Oakland A's have their home opener, and they're going up against the Chicago White Sox. And right now the White Sox are getting the best of the Oakland A's, I believe, as we speak. I believe that it was 2-0, but maybe I'm going to have to check the score here.
It is 2-0 heading to the top of the fourth. The White Sox with three hits. The A's still looking for their first hit of 2016. And really, both the Mariners and the A's, you don't know what you're going to get. Both teams could win 70 games, or they could both win 90, 95 and be in the playoffs.
Yeah, when you look at the Oakland A's lineup, it's just, a lot of these guys, you're like, I don't really know that guy. So Billy Burns, of course, we know Billy Burns. He's now in center field, taking the place of Coco Crisp, a longtime Oakland A's player. And then you got Jed Lowrie at second base. Josh Reddick, who is the cog in this whole lineup. He's actually the elder statesman, if you can believe that, of the Oakland A's. And, man, I believe it's like his fifth season or something like that. So there's like a lot of young guys on this team, but I'm excited because it feels like it's a good clubhouse this year. There are times when you have great players on paper, and then for whatever reason, things just don't gel, and you know why they don't gel. It's because maybe they don't communicate too much in the clubhouse, but I have a great feeling about this group. I don't know how many wins they're going to get. I know it has to be better than the 60 that they had last year. But we'll see. Time will tell. But it's an exciting time of the year.
And it's a tough battle for the A's as they face the White Sox ace, and that is Chris Sale, who said this is the closest to a playoff atmosphere I've ever been in, saying that about pitching tonight in Oakland.
Yeah, he was saying that because he was going up against Sonny Gray, who's one of the best pitchers in the major leagues. And this was, when you look on the schedule, and a lot of analysts and broadcasters were saying, this game was depicted to be the best game on opening day. Now, the Oakland A's haven't done too well as far as home openers are concerned. They won last year. They're trying to get a streak going of two in a row. But prior to that, Sean, they lost 10 of their home openers the previous. And so they're not great when they start out at the beginning of the season, but we know that this is a great franchise because they always seem to be in the hunt, whether it's for their division title or just having great baseball. So,
Sean, looking at the box score from the Mariners-Rangers, listen to this. Just, it's so crazy, the anomalies of baseball. The Mariners get four hits, but just two runs. Conversely, the Rangers get just one hit, but three runs.
Yeah, you had mentioned King Felix walking in a run. That's never good when you're putting ducks on the pond and they're not swinging the bat. And, those types of things happen sometimes. You can pitch a great game, but then if you walk one or two, doesn't take much to get the run in. So, I don't know how King Felix, I watched a good portion of it. I didn't see wild pitches, but something tells me that walks had something to do with it.
Yeah, his control was not under his normal command. He did have five walks, including the walk that allowed the first run for the A's. But, Sean, there's some other news in the Oakland area. The Raiders have made a big splash in free agency, so things are looking up there for the Silver and Black.
Well, yeah, just today, this was something that we knew was going to happen. Of course, the Raiders have beefed up their defense, something fierce. but they just wanted to stabilize everything as far as the pass rush is concerned. And Aldon Smith, the Raiders have signed Aldon Smith to a 2-year deal. Right now it's undisclosed on what that deal is. But Aldon Smith, as we all know, had a troubled past, starting with in San Francisco across the bay. But he's a fierce pass rusher. The Raiders are putting some faith and banking on him to actually continue to do that. And so that's a big deal for Oakland to make sure that they're solidifying the pass rush. I'm excited, Sean. I'm excited about what the Raiders have done in the offseason. Some of the acquisitions that are picked up. Of course, I know you don't like one or two in particular, but man, we're on our way.
Well, here's some interesting news out of NFL land. If you recall, a lot of Thursday night games had teams wearing crazy color combos where they were like head to toe one color, and they call it Color Rush. And now they have announced that every Thursday game will involve both teams wearing these Color Rush uniforms in 2016.
Oh my God. That, that's just great. It looks like you're looking at a bowl of M&Ms when, they wear these solid colors. You see all green and all red, and it's like, what in the world is going on? And why would they do something like that? But it's the NFL. They're always experimenting and trying new things, so we got to put up with it.
Yeah, it's crazy seeing those ridiculous, because sometimes they're nice, other times it's just too much over the top, but apparently there was enough action on, who knows, social media and whatnot to get the NFL to okay it every single Thursday night game. And how about the goings on in the Bay, the goings on in the Bay now is just the Oakland Raiders, but the San Francisco / Santa Clara 49ers and their quarterback with no home, as Colin Kaepernick will not take a pay cut to go to Denver. So now he is still a 49er, showed up for their off-season workout program to get a check of a mere $400,000, yet Chip Kelly doesn't really want him on the team.
It's funny because, I hear differently here in the Bay. I hear that, Colin Kaepernick wants out of San Francisco so bad that he's willing to take a pay cut. Here's what happened just recent, and these are the weird rules with the NFL. The NFL says that a coach and a player can't talk to each other until, their actual OTAs or their practice, their designated practice starts. But what we just found out a couple of days ago over the past weekend is Colin Kaepernick was in Denver talking and having dinner with John Elway. So how does that happen? How is it that a coach can't talk to the player, but, a general manager can? And, what were they talking about? Well, what they were talking about. They were talking about, how disgruntled he is in San Francisco. They were talking about, hey, this would be a great fit for you here in Denver. So it puzzles me how the NFL has these rules to where an actual coach can't talk to his player, but other people can. And, it sounds like Colin Kaepernick, who's guaranteed that money for his contract, he could easily go back to San Francisco and say, hey, I'm going to get this money and trade me for the top dollar. Or I can just tell my agent, it doesn't even matter. I'll take whatever. I'll even take a pay cut. And that sounds like that's what he's gearing towards.
Well, Jason Cole of Bleacher Report has said that he will not take a pay cut that would have had the trade go forward with the Broncos, CBSSports.com putting that out there. And CBS Sports' Jason LaConfora, who you met at the Super Bowl, he has stated that it's all jockeying and there is no real deadline and the trade could happen this month, probably closer to the draft. And really, it's a matter of who between the Broncos and the Niners
what they're going to pay of his $14.3 million contract for 2016.
Yeah, you know, I tend to agree with Jason Lockenfora. It's just a formality. I do not see Colin Kaepernick playing a down in San Francisco. I think that the relationship there is so scorned that, he just can't see himself putting on that uniform anymore. So we're going to see what the Broncos come up with as far as a deal is concerned, and there is no rush. They can figure this out, and what Colin's going to do is he's going to continue to work out and you know, get himself in shape, and you know, hopefully he'll have a team in the next few weeks or so.
You know, Sean, we typically don't talk Cleveland Brown football, but I do want to mention that RG3 is now in Cleveland, and regardless of his injuries and his antics and whether or not he's a true quarterback, he's the best quarterback the Browns have had in years.
Yeah, I think that it's a great fit for RG3 in Cleveland. There were a few options that we thought might materialize, with Ryan Fitzpatrick going through his contract woes with the Jets. Thought maybe that RG3 would wind up there. There were talks that maybe he would go to Denver at one point because we know what's happened there in Denver. They were quarterbackless for a little bit after the Super Bowl, and it couldn't happen. RG3 couldn't find a better team than the Cleveland Browns, and the reason being is Hugh Jackson, in his first year as the head coach, of course, we know him here in the Bay as being a head coach with the Oakland Raiders, doing an awesome job there, bringing the team actually to an 8-8. I say awesome job, but that was probably one of the better records that they'd had in recent years. Goes on to the Cincinnati Bengals and does some great things there as an offensive coordinator. Now he gets the chance to head a team once again. And Hugh Jackson is known as a quarterback whisperer. So if there's anybody who can help bring RG3 back to his form, which I still believe that RG3 has some good football left, he just needs some good counseling and to get his mind right and in the right direction, I think Cleveland's a great fit for him.
Especially if somehow, some way, they can get wide receiver Josh Gordon reinstated.
Yeah, you know, Josh Gordon, man, you talk about somebody that was suspended for a year, and of course, violating the drug policies twice in the NFL, so that is what merited that. It'll be interesting to see if he actually still has that speed and is a deep threat receiver, powerful receiver, as he was before being suspended. But there are a few pieces in place in Cleveland that would allow them to actually look like a presentable team. Now, there are so many holes to fill in Cleveland that, you know, it would be a little silly to catapult them, you know, into that playoff echelon. But you know, they're heading in the right direction. They have the proper coach, I believe. They have the proper quarterback. And so let's see if they can build from there.
And, Sean, I'm a little surprised you haven't jumped on this train, being a former girls basketball coach at Clover Park High School. We have to say a congratulations to the University of Washington women's basketball team for making it to the Final Four, losing yesterday in Indianapolis.
Man, the UW women, not only did they surprise, but they played some phenomenal basketball this year. They had some strong pieces in place, and you know, they had a first year coach because you know their prior coach decided to take another job, and you know, nobody expected the Huskies to do this, the Lady Huskies to do this and make it to the Final Four. But, you know, I did. I jumped on the bandwagon a little late, got a chance to watch them in the, you know, a little bit in the Elite Eight. I watched some highlights and then watched the Final Four against Syracuse. And, my goodness, Syracuse was just too much for the Lady Huskies. And, of course, the Huskies being ranked number 7, which is tied for the highest ranking for any Final Four, NCAA Women's Final Four. So, you know, the Huskies have that as a feather in their cap. And I think that there's nothing but a great and tremendous upside for them moving forward.
Well, Sean, it's been fun being back on the show. Man, you're heading off to Mexico in 2 days. Actually, on that same day, Wednesday, I will be back in the States for a very brief run to Vermont and then right back to Canada, Montreal on Friday.
Yeah, man, you know, for a lot of the listeners, you know, because we get a lot of texts and calls, they say, hey, are you coming into this town? I see the Globetrotters are in this town. Are you here? And, man, we have a lot of tours that go on at the same time. But, yeah, man, I look forward to heading down to Mexico. Got my passport ready. Should be a lot of fun.
Sean, it's been great. Another fun show. Thanks to big-time guest tonight, Jeff Baker of the Seattle Times. You can follow him on Twitter at Jeff Baker Times. Jeff spelled G-E-O-F-F. He had a lot of insight on the Seattle arena goings-on or what is not going on, as well as, you know, his career in journalism and a lot of great stories. And, heck, he even gave me tips on where to go in Montreal.
Yeah, it was great having Jeff on and getting that business acumen part of sports. You know, we don't talk about that too much, but it was great getting his insight, his expertise on that. And as you were saying, and talking about the arena, and I hope something gets done. You know, something has to happen for Seattle. But there, it's not just as easy as, you know, the city council meeting together and saying, yeah, it's a go. You know, it sounds like the NBA is involved in this as well. So there's some other variables that are going on that would allow Seattle to get this team back. And who knows, maybe they would have to backdoor it by getting an NHL team. But either way, you know, it sounds like there are talks going on, Sean, and that's all you can ask for right now.
And Sean, the NCAA Men's Basketball Championship looking like it might be going to Villanova, up 67-59 with 4 minutes remaining. We'll see if the Tar Heels have one more run left in them.
Yeah, actually it's 67-61. We're on a break right now. And so Villanova has the ball with about 4 minutes, 11 seconds left. And who would have thought Villanova, man? I mean, you know, our good buddy Harold Presley, he's a Sacramento native here, lives in Sacramento. And he's over there in Houston right now supporting his beloved Villanova Wildcats. And, you know, it's amazing because he's on a historic team. He was on that team with Ed Pinckney and Raleigh Massimino, and Coach Massimino is there. I believe that his wife took ill, so we didn't know if he was going to show up or not. But, you know, it's good to have locals that are over there that we have ties with. And Harold Presley does a lot of things in the Sacramento area. And so I'm sure he's excited about that right now as his team is up 6 points.
Well, Sean, I don't know if you will be back at home in time for a show next Monday, the 11th. But if not, we will try to get back live on April 18th and move forward from there.
That's right. And if you like to listen to some more archives of the show, you can go to bbsradio.com/DSX, or you can listen to the show that airs every Mondays at 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Of course, we had the awesome Jeff Baker of the Seattle Times on the show and gave us some awesome insight on the arena. He's the enterprise and investigative reporter for the Seattle Times, so it was great having him on. Man, it's been a while, Sean Wally, but this has been a DSX LLC production, and as we always say, you're not in the game unless you take a shot, and when you take that shot, we hope it hits nothing but the bottom of the net. Man, we look forward to talking to you next week, so have a great one, everyone.
Thanks for listening to On the Double with the Double S Express. Join us next Monday for great sports talk and big-time guests. On the Double with the Double S Express.